have dictated the terms of the conversation. So before we start listening, I wondered if anybody can name a Supreme Court decision that affected LGBTQ plus rights in the last couple of decades.
Well, the overturning of DOMA.
Okay, so the overturning of DOMA, that happened in two parts. So the first one was the Windsor decision, which said that you can't tell the states that they can't recognize same-sex marriage. And then the second part of that was called the Obergefell decision, which said that the federal government has to recognize same-sex marriage. Okay, so that's probably the one that's seen as the biggest. But there are several others. Others? Think of one that happened in the early aughts, maybe 04 or 05, something like that.
What?
So there's the Lawrence versus Texas case, which said sodomy laws are unconstitutional. And then there was one just a few years ago. It actually sort of early on in the pandemic it happened. You remember this one? It's called the Bostock decision, which says that because on the basis of sex is included in anti-discrimination laws for jobs, this case was brought for employment, that the word sex includes LGBTQ plus people because the stereotype of a man is that he is in a relationship with a woman. So that is a stereotype that you cannot base laws on. So Bostock, I think Bostock is far, far more important than the same-sex marriage ones, because what ended up happening with Bostock, especially when the Biden administration took over, is that they said, well, all federal laws that say on the basis of sex now should be interpreted to include people, all LGBTQ plus people. So it was a much more far-reaching decision because of the legal analysis than a very narrow decision about one right, same-sex marriage. So those are a few. There are others, but those are the pertinent ones. I think that what you're probably hearing a lot of these days in the news is discussions around, especially after the Dobbs decision regarding abortion, that the same liberties, fundamental liberties guaranteed by substantive due process that were guaranteed or that were expounded upon in the Roe decision and in the Griswold decision for birth control are also implicated in all of these LGBTQ rights laws. So if you start, and if you read Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion, he says that all of these laws, all of these decisions should be revisited based on the Dobbs decision, that there is no fundamental right to privacy because there is no fundamental right to substantive due process, meaning you cannot be deprived of your liberties without without due process. So I don't want to spend a ton of time on that, but I think that it is important that we're in a moment right now when it wasn't the decision, it was a concurring decision by Clarence Thomas that gave a legal justification for undoing several decades of LGBTQ rights. And if you don't think that there are lots of people figuring out how to bring suits that will get to this Supreme Court in the next few years, I think your head's in the sand. So I want to start by playing a piece for you that I produced a couple of years ago. It was on the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. And I'd like for you to think about this question while we're listening to the piece, and then you're going to turn to your neighbors and chat with them about this question. So imagine a scenario in which perfect enemies wasn't the case. What does that look like? This will make more sense once you've heard the piece. What would the case of perfect enemies, what would it look like for perfect enemies to not be the case?
This month marks the 50th anniversary of Stonewall, the uprising at a New York bar that gave rise to the movement for LGBTQ civil rights. But the success of that movement brought a powerful backlash from the modern religious right. And Piers Leila Fadel reports that for decades, the two sides have been counter-activists in a culture war that continues today.
The police raid and the protests surrounding the Stonewall Inn in June of 1969 were a seminal moment.
Movements need icons. Movements need martyrs. Movements need heroes.
That's Lillian Vaderman, an LGBTQ historian, Stonewall, she says, is that icon.
It's not, though, the riots themselves that account for the progress that we've made in recent years. It's what followed the riots. Groups began to organize, to demand rights. Eventually, allies were on our side and helped us fight for the battle for rights.
She points to the formation of the Gay Liberation Front, the first pride parades in several cities a year later to commemorate the uprising. And at first, Baderman says, the religious right ignored these events as blips. But then?
As the gay movement succeeded, and as various cities began to pass gay rights ordinances, that woke the religious right up to begin to push back. The real beginning, I think, of the culture wars in earnest was in 1977.
That's when Anita Bryant, a pop singer and pageant queen, best known at the time as the face of Florida orange juice.
Orange juice with natural vitamin C from the Florida
began a public campaign to fight an ordinance that passed in Miami-Dade County to protect gay, lesbian, and bisexual people from housing and employment discrimination. It captured the national media's attention.
Extremely religious, she says she feels that God has singled her out to spearhead a crusade to prevent admitted homosexuals from teaching her children.
2-1, voters chose to repeal the ordinance.
Her celebrity, because of her efforts on a national scale, this became a national conversation in a way that it hadn't necessarily been.
That's Emily Johnson, a historian at Ball State University in Indiana. Her book, This Is Our Message, profiles female leaders in the modern religious right. Bryant, she says, became an icon in the fight against gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights, traveling across the country to oppose similar ordinances.
As we trace this history from the 70s to the present, we see very much not two separate movements that are each building their own agendas, but two movements that are building their agendas and their talking points in relation to and in opposition to one another.
From the anti-discrimination ordinances, the fight for marriage equality, to today's battles over transgender people's rights to use the bathroom of their choice or continue to serve in the military, each movement is strategizing to counter the other. They are perfect enemies, wrote journalist Chris Bull. That's the title of the book he co-authored on the religious right and the LGBTQ movement. And in the last couple decades,
what we saw was really an amazing string of victories by the LGBTQ rights movement.
Don't ask, don't tell is history. That was the military's policy governing gays and lesbians.
Supreme Court ruled that the Constitution guarantees the right for same-sex couples to marry no matter where they are.
Today, a majority of Americans favor LGBTQ rights, including many people of faith. It's no longer socially acceptable or politically effective, Bull says, to demonize queer people. But
there's still many states where you can be fired for being gay, and perhaps most significantly, trans people are really being targeted by the Trump administration for discrimination.
Groups on the religious right now say this is a freedom of speech and freedom of religion issue, from cake makers to photographers who don't want to serve LGBTQ people and comply with non-discrimination laws. The battles between the two sides, Bull says, continue, but the lines of that culture war have been redrawn. Layla Faldin, NPR News.
And we'll have more coverage of the Stonewall riots as the anniversary.
Just one little thing about that piece, since it actually aired a few months before the Bostock decision came out, which is why we say in the piece that you can be fired in some states for being gay. That is not the case anymore. I mean, it happens, but it's not legal. So I'd like you to pair up with someone, as we have been doing this week, and talk about imagining a scenario in which perfect enemies wasn't the case. What does that look like? So pay attention to what your partner is saying, because if you do choose to speak, I'd like you to say what your conversation partner says, not what you say. This is a journalistic technique, as I have said, where you have to actually listen and not just wait for the other person to stop talking. So pair up, and we'll take about three or four minutes to chat, and then we'll come back together and share. Okay, let's start to come back together. I'd like to hear what you heard from your conversation partners. Remember that I'd like you to not say what you said, but I'd like you to report back to us on what you heard. Okay, who might like to start by sharing what you heard from your conversation partner? And I'll ask you to use the microphone because it helps with everybody's hearing. We are recording this session, but it also helps being able to hear each other. What did you hear? Are you raising your hand?
Oh, no.
No, okay. Here, you are. That magic counting to seven thing really does work.
Well, I heard from Max that, one thing before the internet and everybody had a chance to express everything all the time, there may have been a little bit more of a chance for dialogue in a dialogue way rather than kind of the thing. But also mentioned that there's self-sorting that goes on in communities where a more liberal faction might move and be around a similar community, and vice versa, cities becoming maybe a bit more liberal and rural areas maybe another direction. But it is a very difficult task to have people with such strong opinions just actually have a conversation. So.
The reason I ask this question is that I always wonder if what happened was inevitable. Like, was it inevitable that the only religious voice or the predominant religious voice, there were a few religious voices in favor of same-sex or LGBTQ rights, but almost none in 1969, frankly. Was it inevitable that basically this became a religion versus LGBTQ stuff? And I like us to think about like imagining a scenario in which that didn't happen. What could have happened? What could have gone differently? What did you hear? What did you think about? I mean, one of the things that I think about is that there have always been some people of faith who were in favor of gay rights, but I just don't know that they were talking or talking very loudly or talking consistently during this era. And that's not to blame them, because I think that, I think that religions are, essentially embedded in their societies, and the whole country wasn't anywhere near where it is today. Pew studies show, there's a 2017 one that said 70% of Americans are in favor of LGBTQ plus rights. That's only gone up since then, so it's probably around 72-73% right now. That's pretty amazing, considering that, when Prop 8 passed in California that outlawed same-sex marriage in 2008, that number was significantly lower. It was just under 50% nationally, and now it's at 70% or more than 70%, which is a huge change. So it was way, way low in 68, 69 when Anita Bryant was starting.
I'm wondering.
Wait.
Yeah. Okay. I'm wondering if gay folks were so. Well, I think one of the things that eventually changed mainline denomination policy was that people came out that were in families, in those communities, and that really precipitated the change that happened in sort of denominational policies and the debates that went on for at least a decade or more before that. Really going back to earlier in the 90s, so maybe 15 years. Where in the 70s, I think faith communities that were progressive maybe on issues like, their awareness about race or about global hunger or whatever were, gay people were closeted, even in families. And so I think that might be part of the reason.
I also think, because of all of the, Augustine forward, sin is tied to sex. And so this was, there were religious reasons, maybe not good ones, but, well-developed religious reasons that it became this case. This didn't start with Anita Bryant as far as, right, you know, having fears and phobias around sex. It just, this, we decided to start the piece here because it's the point where it sort of broke onto the national scene in a very big way. Maybe one more person before we listen to our next piece? Yes?
I'm sorry, this isn't to do with the question. It goes back to, because you started with the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if the religious right is lining up to bring something to the Supreme Court that would be, I guess, similar to Dobbs. Mm-hmm. What would that be? Or you just mentioned something that codified something or other, I think, that, but like, would it be like, so in states like Florida, you can't be gay or you can't get married if you're gay, or what do you think they're aiming for? I'm just curious.
I mean, what I think they're probably aiming for is to undo the Obergefell decision. And the Windsor decision, but both of those, so that I couldn't undo the Obergefell decision. The Windsor decision said that states can't make it illegal or legal. Marriage law is not governed at the federal level; it is at the state level. That's what it found, and so it could say that it could try to take it over again. I don't know how they would do it. I'm not a lawyer, but I do think that there are very good lawyers, who work for places like Alliance Defending Freedom, who are looking for the perfect case. Now, if that doesn't happen, I think that there are other ways that will continue to infringe on LGBTQ rights. And the next section of this, the next piece I want to play for you starts to look at how that is going to take shape if it doesn't just go and try to undo. I've done this session before, prior to the undoing of Dobbs, and now that with Dobbs, I really do think that it could go back to the Supreme Court. But what I've done in the past is try to report on all the ways that, despite the Supreme Court's LGBTQ rights decisions, LGBTQ rights could be infringed upon by the court. So let me play this next piece for you, and you'll start to hear how this is happening in the courts, especially in the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court today ruled in a case that pitted religious freedom against gay rights, and the justices unanimously sided with the religious group, Catholic Social Services. The city of Philadelphia had refused to contract with them because the group doesn't accept same-sex couples as foster parents. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the opinion saying that Philadelphia was violating the First Amendment. Curry Cook is with the gay rights group Lambda Legal, which wrote a friend of the court brief in the case. He directs the organization's Youth in Out-of-Home Care project. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, Ari. Thank you for having me.
Begin, if you would, by just giving us your reaction to this decision.
Well, I think it's important to note that the Supreme Court today made a very specific ruling that applies to Philadelphia's system and to the contract that they had with Catholic Social Services, which the court found allowed exemptions. And therefore, they found that this wasn't a neutrally applicable non-discrimination ordinance.
So it sounds like you're saying this might not have the broad sweeping implications that an opinion written a different way would?
Exactly. This does not have broad sweeping implications. And in fact, the court recognized that the importance of non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ foster and adoptive parents and people in the opinion. So it is not a broad sweeping ruling permitting religious discrimination with government funds.
And yet this decision is consistent with a 2018 Supreme Court case, which didn't involve a local government, but in that one, the justices favored religious freedom over gay rights, siding with a baker who refused to make a cake for a same-sex couple. And so it seems like the U.S. legal system right now is generally valuing religious freedom over gay rights. Would you say that's the case?
I definitely think that certain proponents of that theory would like for there to be religious exemptions to non-discrimination laws and allow religious freedom to carry the day and allow folks to discriminate in the name of religion. But the Supreme Court did not endorse such a principle today, nor did they in Masterpiece Cake Shop. In fact, just the opposite. They said that you can have non-discrimination protections in place, you just can't have religious animus, and in this case, you can't have exemptions to a contract. It must be generally applicable.
In this specific case, the Catholic Social Services Organization said no same-sex couple had ever applied to them to be foster parents, and that if they had, the group would have referred the couple to another agency. And there are dozens of other agencies in Philadelphia that gay parents can work with. So do you think the city of Philadelphia picked the wrong fight here by refusing to work with the group?
I think the city of Philadelphia was doing exactly what a government entity should do. It's critically important for cities like Philadelphia, states that are administering their child welfare system, to do so in a non-discriminatory manner, consistent with child welfare standards, particularly because we know LGBTQ youth are vastly overrepresented in the child welfare system compared to their presence in the general population, and often exit care to homelessness because of the lack of affirming placement. So making sure that we have all homes that are available to care for them is critically important.
You know, even if this is a narrowly written ruling, as you say, the Supreme Court is more conservative than it was just a few years ago and has consistently shown an inclination to side with religious freedom over competing interests. Does that change your strategy as an LGBT rights organization going forward?
Well, I think it's really important to center the conversation in what the majority of Americans think, which is that LGBTQ folks should be treated with dignity and respect, and that non-discrimination principles are critically important. And so,
but Lambda Legal is a legal organization. I mean, you're not fighting for votes at the polls. You're fighting for wins in court, right?
Absolutely. But I think our legal strategy is the same, which is to make sure that we're, you know, employing the important protections in the Constitution under equal protection and due process and the Establishment Clause, and making sure that when folks are accessing services, that, you know, it's their interest in equity and equality that carries the day versus any attempt to discriminate or turn them away because of who they are or who they love.
That's Curry Cook, Senior Counsel at Lambda Legal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So I'd like you to pair up again, but with a different person than you paired up with last time. And I want you to, based on this conversation, based on the piece you heard a little bit earlier, I'd like you to talk about this question. What do we mean when we say religious freedom? This is a huge question. And I think this term is bandied around constantly.
Yeah.
And I think that we have a real lack of clarity on this term. So I think that one of the helpful things that we could do is clarify what we mean by it. I think we mean many different things, so I want to hear, you'll probably come up with many different things. So pick a different conversation partner than you had last time, and remember, if you report back, you're going to report back what the other person said, not what you said. And you'll have about 3 or 4 minutes this time.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay.
Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay.
Okay, let's start to come back together. I'd like to hear what you heard from your conversation partners about the meaning of religious freedom. I remember I was assigned, like, very early on in graduate school, a very thick book called The Meaning of Religious Freedom. So let's see if we can distill what he meant by that title down to just a few sentences. So who would like to go first? I heard lots of good conversations. I overheard some interesting things. What do we mean by religious freedom?
So one thing that we discussed is whatever religious freedom is supposed to mean, the way it's being used now is, as my conversation partner called it, a baseball bat to get what I want. You say, you know, I want such and such thing. Well, it's part of my religion, therefore I can get it. It's being used as a tool rather than sort of a protection.
So the Catholic Social Services does not want to facilitate adoptions or foster care to same-sex couples, and so they say, well, that's against our religion. The baker says, I don't want to make a cake for a same-sex wedding, so it's against my religion. How is this different from how else you may have heard the idea of religious freedom used?
Well, I think the line is, you know, there's when you say something like that, you say, I don't want to do this because it's against my religion. Like, that's an acceptable thing to say, but I don't think you should do this because it's against my religion is the conversation that most people are having when it comes to their religion today. And it's a pretty hard line there.
It does occur to me that there's something fundamentally different between somebody saying, I don't want you to get married because of my religion. But there is that is different from, I don't want to facilitate this adoption because of my religion, because you're asking that group to do something that they believe to be against their religion, or bake the cake. So I think that there's this interesting area of religious freedom being carved out in recent years that is different from what we used to mean. When we used to say religious freedom, I think we meant your ability to go to whatever, you know, house of worship you want to go to. And that nobody was going to tell you, no, you have to go to that mosque or that synagogue. They just meant wherever you want to go to church. They didn't mean how you exercised your religiosity in public life. And so that I find really, really interesting.
I may have stronger opinions on this because I'm a social worker, so the whole adoption, and I'm an adopted parent. But it seems to me to say the Catholic Social Services doesn't facilitate adoptions, the state of Pennsylvania does. And so Catholic Social Services saying that we are doing something against our religion is really not true, because all they're doing is a matching. That's all.
But
that's their only
function. But having to match with a same-sex couple is—they say that's fundamentally against their religion.
Yeah, but I think that's a stretch.
I know you and I have had this conversation.
I think it's a stretch because nobody's saying that they have to. They have to do it. Nobody's saying the Catholics have to do it. I'm going to assume the same-sex couple is not Catholic and therefore allowed to practice their religion in their way and take in a child. So it feels like it crosses a line to me of the Catholic saying these other people have to practice our religion that are not Catholic. And the Catholic Church, to me, only has purview over Catholics. That would be how I would see it.
So this I find this decision really interesting because it was unanimous. It was not a 6-3 decision. The entire Supreme Court agreed that Catholic Social Services was right to say it is against our religion, same-sex marriage is against our beliefs, although I will point out that 60% of Catholics believe in same-sex marriage, but Catholicism is not a democratic religion. It is run by a smallish group of people. I also point out that 60% of Catholics also believe in abortion rights, and 85% of Catholics use birth control, all of which is against their religion. But I find it interesting that this was a unanimous decision, and the main reason
by Catholics as well. But anyway,
the Supreme Court is almost all Catholic. The interesting part about this is that the reason they said if Catholic Social Services had been the only organization that placed foster children, they probably would have made a different decision. But as Ari points out, there are dozens. The city. Mm-hmm. Contracts with a bunch of organizations that facilitate these. So if a same-sex couple had applied to Catholic Social Services, Catholic Social Services says they would have sent them to another organization. So they said that this kind of discrimination is legal because there were other options and this is fundamental to the beliefs of this church. Yes.
Doesn't it depend, though, on who the agency is employed by? If it's Catholic Social Services themselves, but if it's somebody operating under the city of Oakland or the U.S. government, don't they then have to follow the non-discrimination policy?
I think that if it's a secular organization, they would have to. I personally find most religious organizations abhorrent in the fact that they don't have to follow any civil rights laws. They can say we don't hire women, we don't hire gay people, we don't hire, some say they don't, they don't ordain black people. So that is all legal in the United States. And as abhorrent as some of us might find that, it is still legal. That's deeply problematic, but still legal. However, here's what I would say. What if, and the reason for this is this, that because of the disestablishment clause, if the government could say, you have, okay, you Catholic Church have to ordain women. That is incredible interference in the religious life of the church. So I think this is a delicate balance. This is not, oh, it's always terrible that churches can do this. It's, you wouldn't want the church to come in and say, well, there are other issues in your congregation, like your congregation can't do X, Y, or Z, or has to do X, Y, or Z.
In Texas, they just passed a law that allows donated anything to schools have to be displayed. So there's an ultra-conservative group that is distributing and giving In God We Trust signs to schools, which under the law they have to put outside. So there's someone right now who has gotten some money, and he's writing the same in Arabic, and he's donating these signs in Arabic, and they have to put them up. It's going to be interesting to see what religious freedom says about that.
He's also donating them with rainbow backgrounds.
Yeah, with rainbow, rainbow backgrounds.
This shows up in the prayers of the people tonight, by the way, which I wrote. So. Other thoughts before we move on to the next piece? Yes?
Picking up on your comment, I understand the decision, as long as there's somebody else that does foster care and, you know, adoption. But, you know, this is playing out around hospitals big time. I mean, and I don't know of, I mean, in the state of Washington, I mean, there's a bill, I think it didn't go through this last year, but it's going to come up again. But, you know, we're the only, in Providence is a huge provider in this state. And related to, you know, gender-affirming care, I mean, and you know, abortions. I mean, it's, when that is the, you know, the community where I live, that's the hospital, you know. And we're talking about... you know, there's a crucifix on the wall, and, you know, almost every room you go into, and that's the community hospital. And you listen to the Lord's Prayer at night at 9 o'clock. And
over the speakers.
Over the speakers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And this is in Everett. I mean, this is not, you know, in yeah.
You can ask for those crucifixes to be removed in individual rooms. My husband had surgery a few years ago, and he's Jewish, and I actually like went in and I said, these need to come down. They weren't happy, but they have to do it. They actually can't make you happy in your room. It's not medically necessary, let us say. So I want to play a piece for you, and I'd like you to think about this question. Let me find a piece for you. I'd like you to think about this next question. What's the best way to achieve LGBTQ rights? So we've talked about courts, and I've mentioned you know, the popularity or lack of popularity of LGBTQ rights in just, you know, the general public. So for instance, when Prop 8 passed in California, which outlawed same-sex marriage, which had been legal in California, that passed by 54-ish%. Maybe 52%. And so that was a popular vote. Many of these decisions have come through the courts. Other states like Connecticut passed same-sex marriage through legislative acts. So those are the three ways things become legal in the United States. They get voted on by individuals, they get voted on by legislatures, or all the law, the changes because of the way the Supreme Court interprets the law. So I want to play this piece for you, and I would like you to think about what is the best way to achieve these rights. And I want you to keep this question in mind, knowing that the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision, just overturned legal abortion throughout the country, even though 60% of Americans say that abortion should be legal. So this is incredibly unpopular. If Americans could agree on 60% on anything, that would be huge, huge. I mean, especially when people win presidential elections by a few hundred thousand votes. So let's like to listen to this piece, thinking about what is the best way to achieve LGBTQ rights.
When President Obama was in office, he took executive action favoring LGBTQ rights. When President Trump took office, he approached the issue differently, with executive actions that were branded as protecting religious freedom. Now that Trump is departing, President-elect Biden can take his own approach. New laws are unlikely with a closely divided Congress, but NPR's Tom Gelton reports there is a lot Biden can do.
At one time, divisive issues were resolved through legislation. Congress has passed both a Civil Rights Act and a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But these days, the action is in the executive branch. President Trump, for example, has pushed a conservative understanding of religious freedom, less that it means keeping the government out of religion, more that it's the freedom to act on your religious beliefs, even if that may affect someone else's rights. And Trump has ordered federal agencies to enforce that understanding. Roger Severino directs that effort in the Department of Health and Human Services.
Every agency has a civil rights office in the federal government. Not every agency, until now, had a religious freedom office, and now we do.
Severino was speaking there on a recent video. His religious freedom office issued a rule, for example, telling service providers that if their religious beliefs conflict with a duty to accommodate LGBTQ people, they can be freed from that duty. In part, this is all a product of the culture wars.
Healthcare and non-discrimination became so partisan.
Holly Holman, the general counsel at the Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, says legislation is no longer an effective way to deal with conflicting religious freedom and anti-discrimination concerns.
We've kind of lost our shared definition and commitment to religious liberty in ways that make that harder to legislate.
President Obama used executive action to push policy changes. In 2014, he ordered that federal contractors cannot discriminate against people on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. 4 years later, President Trump issued a new order. Religious institutions can be exempt from that anti-discrimination rule. Now, that order may be replaced by yet another one. Rachel Lazar is president of Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
We would like to see the Biden administration sign an executive order to restore and protect religious freedom for all Americans and to make clear that religious freedom should operate as a shield to protect us and not as a sword to license discrimination.
Some Trump orders could be easily reversed. Trump directed the government, for example, to hold back on enforcing the so-called Johnson Amendment, which said tax-exempt religious groups can't endorse candidates. Biden could instead strengthen enforcement. Other issues could be settled through the courts. There's now a lawsuit challenging a Trump rule that allows healthcare providers to opt out of medical procedures if those procedures violate their religious beliefs. Lazar says a Biden administration could just choose not to defend the Trump rule.
It is on appeal right now, and we would expect that the Biden administration would not carry forward with any type of appeal and would sort of cut that off at the knees.
But that might not necessarily be the end of it. If the Biden administration manages to undo some Trump religious freedom order, an outside group on its own could take up that cause and push it all the way to the Supreme Court.
The undoing will give rise to legal challenges.
Louise Melling is Deputy Legal Director for the American Civil Liberties Union.
The court is clearly in the midst of reconceiving some of our religion statutes in the Constitution, I think.
So these battles over religious freedom and non-discrimination will continue despite a change of presidents. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
So that piece aired probably a few weeks before Biden was inaugurated. But I just wanted to give you a sense of the landscape. So why don't you turn to a different conversation partner than the last time and talk about what is the best way to achieve LGBTQ rights. Talk to somebody that's different from whom you talked to last time, and we'll give you 3 or 4 minutes, and then you'll come back, and you're going to tell me what your conversation partner says. I'm always glad when people don't want to stop talking because they're interested in the topic, but I'd like us to have a little bit of time to share before we run out of time. So let's come back together, and I'd like you to report what you heard from your conversation partner. that the best way to achieve LGBTQ rights? What did you hear?
I don't think we solved the problem up here.
You did, okay. I think it's solvable.
But we did feel that once the movement became more mainstream, it was more accepted. Mm-hmm. And that maybe why the Northwest just is okay with it is because it became more mainstream. And we did suddenly realize people who were in these groups were not going to do our children or whatever, great harm. That's just part of the fabric of life.
It's interesting that part of the rhetoric of these laws tends to be that in fact the people who are in the majority, Christians in America, are being discriminated against if they have to treat people equally or with equal under the law.
And that is freedom of religious freedom. If I have to treat you as an equal.
Yeah, that's what they.
Whoever
that's
you are,
that is their argument.
And that matter not. You can be colored. You can be a different religion. You can be.
Right, but they would argue that is an infringement on their religious liberty. So it's interesting to me that like a majority in America has somehow managed to figure out and win in many cases in legal situations where they say they are a discriminated against minority in the United States. I think that's fascinating. That's where we are in the moment when, in fact, LGBTQ people are the minority in America and face quite a bit of discrimination, much of it not legal anymore. But some of it legal, if you can say there's a religious reason for that. For it. What else did you hear from your conversation partners? Oh, yes, sorry.
My conversation partner made a very good point of where is the line drawn of if there's a heterosexual couple that is getting married and it might be in a religious establishment or be in elopement, but they are not of faith of any sort. They might be atheist or outside of that. And so where's the line drawn of what is marriage not acceptable if it is not of faith or if it is not affirmed by the church? So where is the line drawn? Why is it okay for a heterosexual couple to be married in a non-affirming church, but it's not okay for a gay couple to be married in a church? And so it would just be okay just because it's under the quote-unquote biblical form of marriage, whether they are religious or not. But a even religious gay couple, depending on the church, might not be able to be married in the same place.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anybody is arguing to make a church perform a same-sex wedding. I mean, I don't know that is the case. I mean, you could argue within that church to try to like change the policy, but I don't think anybody's arguing that the federal government just should or even could try to do that within the church. The equality is before the law, not before, I guess, God.
Yeah.
Or the church. I don't think that God and the church are in any way analogous. did you? I saw someone. Somebody else would like to.
And that's where the religious right would disagree with you.
How so? Say more.
God and church are not. I mean, God and government are not the same people.
Well, I mean, as we heard, if you were here on Tuesday, there are many movements afoot that want to say that America is a Christian nation, and that we should only elect Christian leaders. But I think they only mean. I don't think they mean me. I don't think they mean Brenda. I think they mean somebody else. So, not that I would ever run for office. Because
Pastor Mark.
I would never.
Perfect.
Okay.
Exactly. Right.
And
kids. Oh my God. This is all. It's perfect.
Any? Yes.
Going back to that Tuesday conversation, if the theocrats win, we won't have this problem because the laws will reflect Christian, certain Christian, you know, perspective. But it's like that. I mean, that's where the, you know, that's sort of where the tension is now. I mean, at a foundational level, you know, these folks are not accepting what many of us understand to be the foundation of this, you know, society and the pluralism and the constitutional protection. So, yeah, I mean, it's yeah, if we just had, you know, quote, Christian law.
Well, I mean, tomorrow we're going to talk about abortion rights and, you know, you said if the theocrats win. Well, there are... there are religious groups that say that abortion is not just a right, but it's the right thing to do if, say, the life of the mother is at risk. And so we're going to actually hear about a lawsuit specifically. It's a religious freedom lawsuit brought by a group of Jews in Florida that says you're infringing on our religious freedom to terminate that pregnancy if the life of the mother is at risk. I want to end, we are out of time, but I would like to end with a poem that I found, and if any of you was in the village, when was that? In June, you've heard this, so I apologize, but no, I don't apologize, it's a great poem, so you should hear it again. It's called, it's by the poet Jay Holm, and he is the poet in residence at St. Giles in the Fields, which is an Anglican church in central London. It's called Jesus at the Gay Bar. He's here in the midst of it, right in the center of the dance floor, robes hitched up to his knees to make it easy to spin. At some point in the evening, a boy will touch the hem of his robe and beg to be healed, beg to be anything, anything other than this. And Jesus will reach out his arms, sweat damp, and weary from dance. He'll cup the boy's face in his hands and say, "My beautiful child, there is nothing in this heart of yours that ever needs to be healed." Thanks for coming today. Tomorrow we'll talk about abortion rights, a really light topic for a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, Friday afternoon.